The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is Yom Yerushalayim in New York.
40 years ago, in 1967, the Israeli paratroopers turned a corner and stopped dead in their tracks, because there before them lay the substance of dreams. You know, for 19 years, the Jewish people were forbidden, were prevented from arriving at the Kotel. All they could do was dream. And in a moment, on the wings of eagles, the Jewish people came home. And if you've ever seen the picture, you have to close your eyes. And you have to imagine what it must have been like. These dirty, grubby, tired, exhausted paratroopers. Most of them with friends that they'd left behind in the last couple days, dead on the battlefield, finally arrived at the Kotel. And the pent-up emotion of a month, of the most intense month, of a week of war, it's hard to describe what that must be like, and paratroopers cried, and everything just came out. And then Rav Goren, the chief rabbi of the Israeli army, arrived at the Kotel. And the men, when they saw Rav Goren, who was a paratrooper like them, lifted him up on their shoulders, and he pulled out a shofar. And the sound that you're about to hear is the sound that they heard. The same sound, the same shofar. And the reason we blow a shofar is not just like on Rosh Hashanah, where we think of repentance, of tshuva, of what it might have been like. The shofar is also the heralding of redemption. The great shofar will sound. We have a long way to go. We're not there yet. So take a moment. Don't miss this moment. You should stand up, close your eyes, and when Rav Shor blows, when Rav Sam blows the shofar, take a moment to appreciate how blessed we are that we live in a generation where you can just get on a plane and go to Israel, and imagine what it would be like to be in Israel, and maybe next year on Yom Yerushalayim, we'll be there. I have a good friend named Yossi Weil. This is an Alantrut. And he was one of the paratroopers who took back the Kotel. And he told me two things that stuck with me about his experiences coming into the Old City in 1967. He had played in the Rova, in the Jewish Quarter, as a boy. And obviously after we lost the Jewish Quarter in 1948, so he, like everybody else, hadn't been back there in 19 years. And when they came into the Old City, and he found himself back in the Jewish Quarter, he didn't recognize him. And he said that when he saw, and you have to understand, the Jordanian Legion, to their credit, protected the Jewish civilians of the old Jewish Quarter in the Old City in 1948 under a Red Cross agreement. And the 1,400 civilians were allowed to leave when we were forced to surrender the Old City. The Arab mobs, when they saw that they weren't going to be able to take out their vengeance on Jewish lives, instead took it out on Jewish property. And 90% of the buildings, some of them centuries and centuries that they stood there, neighborhoods that were hundreds and hundreds of years old, in some cases thousands of years old, were burned. And everything was destroyed. When they came back into the Jewish Quarter, they were just mounds of rubble. Synagogues were destroyed, Batei Medrash, Yeshivot, the great Churva Synagogue, which was such a magnificent structure, which is actually now finally being rebuilt, almost 40 years later, 60 years later, had been used as a pen for goats. And there was so much manure in the floor of what was left of the Churva Synagogue, it took them almost 4 months to clean it out, literally bucket by bucket. They found pieces of Torah scroll in the manure. He said that when they got into the Jewish Quarter and they saw what was sitting there, paratroopers just broke down. He said he just started to cry. In the middle of a war, just started to cry. And so on the one hand, you know, tremendous pain. On the other hand, it's He tells another story. They were, lechima b'shetach banui, fighting in a built-up zone from a military perspective, is a very difficult type of warfare. It's very difficult for a number of reasons. First of all, you know, when you're fighting in a built-up zone, so you have to worry not just about the enemy, but you have to worry about civilians. You never know what's waiting around the corner. You have to be very careful when you fire. Especially in the old city of Yerushalayim, there are holy places. The Israeli army didn't want to use tanks or artillery. You're also worried about a dutz tadi, about accidentally firing on your own troops. You have different units and they're moving in different directions. So warfare in a built-up zone, like in a city, is very, very slow. And very often you'll take one street or one alleyway, and then you'll have to wait until the command center says that it's safe to move on. So they were sitting at one point, they were taking cover behind a wall, and they were in a war zone. There were Arab snipers, the Jordanians had no such compunctions, they were using mortars, there was artillery fire, there were still a lot of troops in the area, they were in the middle of a war. And they're sitting there, and he says that it's hard to describe the feeling. Like they were pinching themselves. The Israeli army, after 2,000 years, is taking Yerushalayim. They're 3 or 4 blocks away from the Kotel. They're about to retake Har HaBayit. Now, he was a religious fellow. He was one of the only kippot in his unit. He started wondering if they were just going to go up and start building the temple. I mean, this is stuff out of the books of prophets. And as they're sitting there, and he's just, the whole thing is surreal. So he turns around and he sees a little old man with a long white beard and a long black coat and the most incredible smile on his face. Just light emanating from every ounce of his being. And this clearly holy person is just walking down the street, headed for the Kotel, with the most incredible smile. And he says there was an aura about him. And he was just in shock. We're in the middle of a war zone. And he looks at this fellow, and he thinks maybe he's dreaming. And all the other guys in the unit, they're all taking cover behind this wall, and they're sitting down low because there's sniper fire, and there's artillery. And here's this man with a white beard, this rabbi, whoever he is walking down the street with a big smile on his face, bullets whizzing area, doesn't matter, walking to the Kotel. So all these paratroopers stand up and they start to follow him because they're convinced that he's the Mashiach. Now it turns out that he was Rav Aryeh Levine, and if you know who Rav Aryeh Levine was, Tzaddik in Yerushalayim, so he heard that the Israeli army was back at the Kotel, that we were back in the old city, he just couldn't wait. If you're a Rabbi Levine and they've come into your shrine, but you're going to wait? If you want to be there, put the first brick on. So he came in, oh, it's this war zone, there are bullets flying. It tells you something about the day. That a company of paratroopers, most of whom hadn't put on tefillin, probably ever, certainly since their bar mitzvah, just stood up and naturally assumed that the Mashiach was here. Right? And unfortunately, there was no Chabad van there, so. But, very complicated day. And you know, if you go to Yerushalayim tonight, and you went to the plaza of the Kotel, indescribable. If you've never been to Yerushalayim, and you're in Yerushalayim, you owe it to yourself to be there. To go there next year, it's amazing. Tens of thousands of Jews, they come from all over the country, and they dance through the streets of New Jerusalem, and they pour into the walls. In fact, this afternoon in Yerushalayim, there was a massive march, right? The youth groups come from all over the country, the army participates, they dance in through the gates of Yerushalayim, not just the Jaffa gate, but the Shechem gate, all the gates, Shaar HaMeset. And they dance in to the old city, through the Muslim quarter, through the Jewish quarter, until they all arrive at the Kotel, and then they burst into song, and their circles of dancing. It's unbelievable. And we get so immersed in the power of the moment, of what we've received, that we sometimes forget what it took to get it. So to be honest, I'm not interested in giving you a whole lecture and a whole shiur. I want to try. You know, it's very hard to experience Yom Yerushalayim in New York City. This is a challenge. So I want to tell you just one piece of a story. We have at Israelite, we're running a 6-week program. We have a group of students from all over, from South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. And on Sunday, just this past Sunday, because Yom Yerushalayim was coming, we took them to a very special place. There's a hill that's just north of the old city. And you could make a case for saying that the battle for the old city of Yerushalayim began on this hill. Some of you may have heard the name. It's called Ammunition Hill, Givat HaTachmoshet. And most tourists don't go there. It's not a tourist site. I guess because today tourists, they get there and it's such a quick trip. So what do you have time for? You go to Masada, you go to the Golan, you go to the old city, you go to Tzfat, you don't have time for anything else. But this is a hill worth visiting. And you have to understand the background to this story. First of all, I've met especially college students who get challenged when it comes to the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War, we fired the first shots, the Israeli Air Force started the war, we're the aggressors. You have to understand the background, just historically, the Six-Day War. At the end of April in 1967, after 11 years of a ceasefire that had stood the test of even the UN's negotiating skills, there was a UN peacekeeping force that was in the Sinai, south of Israel, as a buffer zone between Egypt and Israel, as a result of events that caused the war in 1956. And Nasser, who was then the president of Egypt, and Syria, and a number of other Arab countries, began preparing for what they thought was finally going to be the final showdown. And the airwaves began to fill with a diatribe of, you know, you've heard it before, we'll push them into the sea, this will be the shortest-lived state in the history of the world, you know, we're going to destroy these Jews, etc., etc., etc. And in the end of April 1967, Euthant, the president of the UN, was given 24 hours to evacuate his UN peacekeeping mission from the Sinai. The UN basically pulled back their troops without so much as buying a mind. Euthant's diplomacy mission failed, and all of a sudden there was no buffer zone. The next thing that Egypt did was to close the Straits of Tiran. If you know a little bit about geography, this waterway is vital to Israel's economic survival. Most of the shipping goods that come in through the Straits of Tiran up to the port of Eilat. There was an international brokered agreement that was violated. Straits of Tiran were closed. And then the third thing that Nasser did was to move massive amounts of troops up to the border with Israel. Now you have to understand, you know, we have this perception that the Israeli army stands, you know, strong. The standing army of Israel is not really the army that fights and wins her wars. The job of the standing army of Israel, which is about 15% of the actual army of Israel, is just to hold the line until the reserves get up there. Okay? And the day that Egypt massed her troops on the southern border of Israel, Syria massed her troops on the Golan. There were three full divisions that were brought to bear on the border overlooking Egypt. Syria began an unprovoked, almost non-stop attack by artillery on the Yishuvim, on the settlements and the kibbutzim of the north. An average of 1,000 artillery shells a day fell down, rained on the kibbutzim of the north, northern settlements, in May of 1967. Israel was forced, you know, if you have these massive armies on your border, you have to call up your reserves. You can't wait to see if they're attacked. I mean, anybody who, if you've never experienced this, by the way, you can come to Yerushalayim. You can go up on the roof of a yeshiva called Hakotel, which is the tallest building in the old city. And if you look to the east on a clear day, you'll see Jordan. You'll see the mountains of Jordan. And if you look to the west, you'll see the Mediterranean Sea. You can look across the border of Israel, the entire country, from one rooftop. It gives you an idea of the size of the country. It takes about 90 seconds for a jet to cross the border and reach the sea. And tanks and treads from the north could reach Tel Aviv in the space of about 8 hours. So you don't have time to play games. So Israel has to call up her reserves. So 85% of the men in Israel are now in the army, and they're sitting on the borders. And Israel's economy grinds to a halt. And what do? And how long can you last? And the airwaves are full. And you know, we look back on this now, and people talk about how these were incredible times in the Six-Day War. I mean, I don't really remember. I was 4 years old at the time. Now you can do your math. But understand, right? Understand. They didn't know that they were going to get a Six-Day War. They had no idea what was coming. One of the jokes was that the last one out of Lod Airport should turn off the lights. I mean, you know, this was only a 19-year-old country. And they were surrounded by enemy armies that outnumbered them in most places 11 to 1. And they didn't know that they were going to make it through the week. Israel reached the point where she was on the verge of economic collapse. There's, by the way, an incredible book called The Six-Day War, written by Michael Oren, which is based on released documents over the last number of years. Really worth reading. The military reached the conclusion that if the war didn't begin within 3 days, they would not be able to afford to see it through. They wouldn't have, you know, just the gasoline that they were using up with all the vehicles and the tanks sitting on the border. You have to rev them up every day. You have to check the engines. So Israel finally made her decision. And in the early morning and dawn of June 5th in 1967, the Israeli Air Force, 93% of her planes, flew south first in three separate sorties. Basically, they were timed so that as one Air Force group completed its bombing runs, the next one began. And in the space of about 3 hours, 85% of Egypt's Air Force was knocked out on the ground. By midday, they had basically done the same thing in the north. The Syrian Air Force was wiped out. And by 12:30 on June 5th, basically Israel controlled the skies. And the war had been won before it was even begun. And there unleashed and began the next 6 days. You could spend a week just analyzing each of these days. 6 days of creation, 6 days of change. Around about the second day of the war, the Israelis realized, you know, we now have a telegram. A lot of papers have been released, declassified. Levi Eshkol, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, sent a secret telegram to then young Crown Prince Hussein of Jordan, begging him not to get involved in the conflict. Israel obviously was not looking for a third front. She had to worry about Egypt in the south, Syria in the north. There were Lebanese troops participating in the border conflict, so they were hoping that Jordan wouldn't get involved. Jordan, whether because they really wanted to lay claim to the stake that they had in the West Bank, whether because they were being pressured, is anybody's guess. But Jordan actually began on the second day of the war an unprovoked artillery bombardment. They had 6-inch guns on two hilltops, and one of them was Ammunition Hill. And they began to bombard the new city of Yerushalayim. Okay, all of the western side of the city, certainly the northwestern side, just sat underneath Ammunition Hill. So Israel finally decided that enough was enough. And I think, this is just a personal opinion, I think that from the beginning of the war, Israel had her eyes set on the pearl of the Middle East, on the jewel in the crown, on the heart of the Jewish people, the old city of Yerushalayim. Now, if you come to the old city, correction, when you come to the old city, and when you come to visit Israelite, and when you come up on our rooftop, it doesn't matter if you don't hear any Torah there, it doesn't matter if you don't see me or Rabbi Aaron or anybody else, if all you did was to come up and stand on the rooftop of Israelite for 60 seconds, it'll be worth your coming to Israel. It's an incredible view. And you can see Ramat Eshkol, Givat HaTachmoshet, Ammunition Hill. You can see Mount Scopus, Harat Sofim, just behind the Gold Dome. You can see Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, right next to Terra Sancta in the Augusta Victoria. You can see Armon HaNatziv, the Hill of the High Commissioner. All hills. Israel is called in the Navi and the Prophets, Ir Harim Savivla, a city surrounded by mountains. So in order to take the old city of Yerushalayim, you have to control the strategic high ground. You have to take those mountaintops. And of course there was another problem. And that is that although Israel had air superiority, they couldn't use their air force in the old city of Yerushalayim. You can't bomb the old city of Yerushalayim. First of all, there are civilians there. And second of all, there are holy places that are the nechus of the Jewish people. You can't use tanks. You can't use artillery for the same reason. So this part of the war was going to have to be fought and won by the infantry. They were going to have to take the old city with their hands. So at the very least, they had to take the strategic high ground around. Otherwise, the infantry troops would be slaughtered. So the toughest nut to crack was Ammunition Hill. 10 o'clock, third night of the war, second night of the war, they decided that it was a go. And a full battalion of paratroopers, about 250 plus men, set out with a company of tanks for support. They got to the lower area below Ammunition Hill, and they hit a heavily mined field full of tank obstacles. The tanks got stuck in the obstacles, blown up by mines. Of course, by this time, the Jordanians, the top of this hill was a barren hill. had a police station and a police school. It was a heavily fortified position. Like I said, they had guns up there, 6-inch guns. They had artillery pieces, heavy machine guns. And the infantry realized they would have to go on alone. So this paratrooper battalion began to fight their way up the hill. When they finally made it through to the top of the hill, they encountered probably the most heavily fortified, entrenched gun position in the war of 1948 and 67 combined. The Jordanians had done something very clever. You know, trench warfare is a difficult type of warfare. And basically when you fight in trenches, so one person is firing and the other person is covering him. And then when he either runs out of ammo or, you know, gets to a point where he's sort of behind a kuch and someone else has to cover, so the next guy moves up. And that's how you do it, you leapfrog. You shoot a little, and then he moves up, and you move up. So the Jordanians had built trenches that were so narrow that you could only fit through one at a time. Right? You've got web gear on. So what do you do? You have a whole unit. You're trying to fight your way through trench warfare. You have to take every single piece, every kuch, every bunker, because if you leave enemy troops behind you, that can be a disaster. So on the spot, without thinking about it, each paratrooper, as he runs out of ammo, just hits the ground. And the first one, so the legend is, just screams, Alai, on me. And as each paratrooper runs out of ammunition, the rest of the unit just runs over him. They carried the entire unit, and basically the Jewish people on their backs. And then the Jordanians, realizing what was going on, set up a heavy machine gun position up on top of a water tower. And the machine gun position, because of its height, was able to fire into the trenches. So they were cutting the paratroopers to shreds. And they couldn't proceed. So the men who were in front, whoever they were, realized that the only way to deal with this was to roll out of the trenches into open ground, draw the fire of the gun tower, fire back at the gun tower, hoping to take it out, so that the men could advance. Of course, that was a suicide mission. So as each paratrooper rolled out into open ground to draw fire from the tower, they were cut down. And one after another, just did the same thing. Suicide mission. When they finished this battle, they tried to analyze who had given these orders? Who had ordered these men to do this? And no one could recall hearing any such orders. These men just understood that they had a calling, that they had to do this. And the story that gets to me the most is the story of Yoav Tzuli. Yoav Tzuli realized there was a certain point, later it became known as the Mishulash Ayesh, the Triangle of Fire. There was a machine gun position set up at the far corner of the field. There was a bunker. The bunker was cutting them to pieces. They had no way around it. So Yaakov Tzuli jumped out into open ground with a machine gun and just charged this bunker over 60 yards of open ground. Somehow gets to the bunker, jumps up on top of the bunker like out of the movies, and begins to throw grenades inside the bunker through the slit and takes out the bunker. He does this 3 times in the course of the battle, and the 3rd time he was killed. And there's a monument to his memory in the middle of the field. But the part of this that gets me the most is that you walk up on this hill and basically you see everywhere you look these beautiful, magnificent olive trees. There are 182 olive trees planted on top of this hill. One for each of the men who fell there that day. This is the 2nd costliest battle in Israeli military history. There were 250 men that went up on this hill. There were only 11 who succeeded in walking off unscathed. Do you understand this? 11 men still standing out of 250 men. They thought that the battle would be won by dawn. It took until the nightfall of that day until the guns finally fell silent. So the question is, I guess, why? What's so important about this city? What could cause people to do that? To be willing to do that? And for what? For a piece of real estate? I mean, 3 times a day we pray about Jerusalem. Every time we eat, we talk about Jerusalem. We remember Jerusalem when we get married. We talk about Yerushalayim when we die. We mention it at every simcha. What's so important about Jerusalem? So I'll share with you one quick idea. Because it's late and it's hot and we got to do some jamming. Rav Soloveitchik makes a magnificent point. You know, when we first came to the land of Israel, as a people, with Joshua, the son of Nun, leading us. And we conquered Israel from the outside in. We crossed the border, we headed south, right? We actually went first west to the area of Shechem, right? The two mountains, Har Gerizim and Har Eval. Then we headed south to Gilgal, then we took Yericho, then we went to the Valley of Elah. And we basically took the areas one by one. And then eventually King David came, and he took Jerusalem. We conquered the first time from the outside in. And according to the Rambam, according to Maimonides in the sixth chapter of the laws of Beit HaBechira, of the temple, Perek Vav, he says, this Kedusha, this sanctity, was a sanctity of kibush, of conquest. We sanctified it, it became kadosh, it became holy, it became ours, because we conquered it. And when we lost it, it was no longer conquered. And so it lost its sanctity. But Yerushalayim, says the Rambam, Yerushalayim's sanctity remains forever. There are two sanctities that remains forever. One of them is Yerushalayim, and the other is those places that Ezra came back to. When we built the second temple and the Jews came home, all the places that they resettled, and you could interpret the Rambam to mean all the places that we continue to resettle, we make a statement that we never gave up on them in the first place, and therefore they become kadosh, they become sanctified. The sanctity of the second return, the sanctity of the second temple, that sanctity, that's kedusha that lasts forever. Because that's not kedusha of conquest. That sanctity, that came from inside. And why was the sanctity of Yerushalayim, according to the Rambam, forever? Because unlike the sanctity of conquest that came from the outside in, this kedusha, the sanctity of Yerushalayim, came from the inside out. That's a whole different level of kedusha. And it's very interesting. You know, we don't celebrate the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple, the first time around. If you ask the average person in this room, when was the temple, the first temple, the Beit HaMikdash, finally dedicated, when was it built? I'm not so sure there'd be that many people in this room that know. In fact, everybody goes to shul on this day, and nobody talks about this. Does anybody know when the first temple was dedicated by Shlomo? Yom Kippur. And nobody talks about it, because it didn't last. And even the return of the second, you know what we really talk about that has to do, what's the festival that talks about the dedication of the temple? No? Hanukkah. Hanukkah. You know why? Because you know what Hanukkah is? We've talked about this, some of us, before. What is Hanukkah? Hanukkah, you could make a case for saying that the root of Hanukkah is similar to the word chen. Right? Hanukkah. So they encamped, but also they had chen. In fact, chen may also be the root of the word chinuch, education. Now, why is chinuch and chen? What is chen? So I'll tell you how I figured out what chen is. Chen is an interesting story, right? You know, it's like when you're a kid. If you're 6 years old and you go to synagogue, you have this big debate. Because on the one hand, somewhere in the shul, there is that most, you know who the most important personality in a synagogue is? The Candyman. That's exactly right. If you're 6 years old, you got to know who the Candyman is. But the problem is, you got to pay a price. If you go to the candy man and you get the candy, what do you also get? You get that little, right? He eats you, right? Oh, such chen. Thank you very much, right? So what is chen, right? So I remember once, I was not the kind of guy who was ever, you know, I just wasn't into the whole blind date shidduch thing. It wasn't my thing. I didn't think I would meet my wife on a blind date. But once I went on a blind date, I had a few friends. They worked on me, they nudged me for like 3 months. You gotta meet this girl, she's amazing, you gotta marry her, you'll never forget her, unbelievable, you're the man. So finally, to get them off my back, I decided, okay, I'll go on this date, right? So you know how it is, right? You know, you put on a red sweater, she puts on a blue sweater, maybe it's vice versa, maybe she had a pink sweater, right? I'm walking down the street, we're gonna go in front of Ataras, right? We'll meet, I'll be the guy with the red sweater, I'm walking down the street, I see there's a girl there, she has the pink sweater, I take one look at her, oh my God. Now I know that we're supposed to look at the inner beauty, at the character traits, at the midot. But you know, there's a reason that the Kohanim have beautiful clothes. You have to start from the outside. The outside wasn't good, you know? I was really struggling with this one. It was so bad, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but it was so bad, I debated just taking off my sweater, throwing it in an alleyway, and telling her that Nebuch Bini Friedman could make it, but you know, you can't do that, because then the week after that, you'll be on an LL plane, and you'll happen to sit next to her, and then you'll be in trouble, right? So you have to... So I said, okay, I'll go. So I woke up, but I made my excuses before it was too late. You know, I said, listen, I really, something came up and I really can't stay, but I didn't want you to think that I was ditching or that I heard something. So I came, but I can't stay long, so like I cover myself, right? So we're going through our taras, which doesn't exist anymore, and we sit down and I order the soup. Soup is safe. You can make soup last or you can slurp it up fast. You know, you're covered. So I order the soup, we're sitting and talking, and the truth is this girl was hysterically funny. Very funny girl. And we got into this great conversation. And I was actually having a good time. And I started thinking, you know, this is silly. Like, I don't really have anywhere to go. And I'm having a good time. I mean, I'm not going to marry the girl, but I can have, you know, a fun time. And the truth is, I was starting to think, okay, she's not for me. She's not so pretty, but yeah, she's cute. It's okay. So I stuck it out. I finished the soup. And I'm thinking, you know, this girl is cute. She's not for me. But she's a nice girl. I'm having a good time. She's cute. So I ordered the grilled cheese. Okay. There's no mystical meaning there. I just like grilled cheese. You can tell I like grilled cheese. So I ordered the grilled cheese, and we're having a good time, and she's very funny, and I'm killing myself laughing. And I start thinking, oh, this girl is really cute. She's not for me, but she's really cute. So I get the cheesecake. So by the end of the cheesecake, I decided this girl was really cute. And I actually decided that I had a friend who had to meet this girl. And I nudged him for a month. He actually finally went out with her and they got married. That's a whole other story. It's all the cheesecake, right? But I was thinking about this afterwards. How does a girl go from being, I'm going to get in trouble here, horrendous, to being cute? Really cute. That's chen. Chen is beauty that comes from the inside. You know, some people, they look so beautiful, and then they start to open their mouth, and there's no chen. Some people, you may not perceive it right away, but if you let it come out, that's chen. And the reason that that's the root of chinuch, because education, chinuch, is all about discovering the inner beauty. People think that teaching is about imparting knowledge. That's not true. Real teachers succeed in finding the beauty that's already in their students. That's what chinuch is about, and that's what Chanukah was about. Chanukah. They didn't build a temple. They just came to a temple that had been polluted. There were pigs running around the sanctuary. There were idols to Jupiter up on the altar. And it looked such a schmutz. But they cleaned it up and they uncovered the hidden beauty. And they restored the temple. That's the Kedusha of the Mikdash, of the temple. And that's the Kedusha of Yerushalayim. It comes from inside. And it comes from us. And this is our single greatest challenge today. Because we've lost that. We've covered up that inner beauty. There's so many Jews, who don't even know how much beauty there is in Yerushalayim. Do you know that only 17% of Jews in America have ever visited Israel? You want to hear an unbelievable statistic? Over 60% of Israelis, have never visited Yerushalayim. You think you're all true? We're working on it. 59 and a half, right? We have a lot of work to do. There's so much beauty. And I wonder if that isn't what we need to work on. That's the test of Yom Yerushalayim. You know, 40 years ago, people were willing to give up everything that we could have this city, that we could walk in the city. And I think we owe it to them to make sure that we get to the city, that we see why this is really the heart of the Jewish people. So if you're not ready to live in Yerushalayim or live in Israel, which is where we all should be, at least be sure that you visit Yerushalayim. No Jew should go a year without being in Israel. You know, when you take a good look at how much you spend the next time you go on a date, this is boggling mind for me, you know? So take a look at how much you spend on a date. Multiply that by 5 dates, and you got a trip to Israel. You know? And if it's true, and I got news for you, you'll meet, and that's without like special scholarships from Israelite or Eshet Torah or whatever else it is, right? And then you can get good scholarships, these are 2 dates, right? Depends on the guy, I know. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for coming. We could talk about Yerushalayim all night. We're going to jam a little. Feel free to stay, feel free to go, feel free to eat, feel free to have a good time. I thank you all for coming. I hope, as Rat Hashem, you know, it's a very special thing that there's such an audience of people that care enough about Yerushalayim to come, to dance, to sing. I hope, God willing, soon we'll be dancing in Yerushalayim. And again, thank you to everybody for organizing this. Thank you especially Rabbi Ashur. And Chag Sameach.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.